Hey everyone, Rosie here. Before we get started with this episode, we just want to send a big thank you to our partner, Grind Coffee Co. for their support of the show. They're a convenient subscription service offering specialty grade, single source, 100% Arabica coffee available in whole bean and drip grind. Check out grindcoffeeco.com.
Hey everyone, this is Brian Holsley with Cruise Culture Magazine. You're listening to The Builder Sessions.
Welcome to The Builder Sessions, a podcast where we chat with your favorite builders.
We get to know them, their stories, and hopefully inspire you to get off the couch and build something cool. I'm Hoff.
And I'm Rosie. And on this episode, we chat with Brian Holsley from Cruise Culture Apparel and Magazine. We chat about his experience as an architectural technologist, his experience with overcoming work-related mental illness, and his venture into a passion project that helped him reconnect with his love of cars.
Please enjoy our interview with Brian.
Brian, welcome to the Builder Sessions.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. For our listeners who don't know a ton about you, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll just kind of dive into this interview.
Yeah, so my name's Brian Holsley. I am a architectural technologist with Eagle Builders out of Black Falls. But my real passion is cars, and I started Cruise Culture Magazine just over a year ago now.
Nice. What's this architectural technologist? Like, I've heard of an architect, Vandelay Industries, Seinfeld. And what's an architectural technologist? What do you do? And what is that? Like, how'd you get into that? And then, like, how does one become one of those?
Yeah, for sure. So it's interesting. Like I said, my passion's always been cars and hot rods and stuff. And when I started high school, I took all of my like welding classes, shop classes, mechanics classes, all that stuff. But I wound up with one empty slot in my schedule. So I filled it with drafting. We called it, I can't remember what we called it, the class itself. Design studies. That's what it was.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So I took that to fill my time, and it was basically like AutoCAD and drafting houses and buildings and learning about construction and that stuff. So I filled my empty slot with that class, wound up being really good with it. I never missed any assignments. Everything just, you know, was super natural and easy for me and did really well in the class. So I wound up taking all 3 years of design studies in high school. And then when I graduated high school, a bunch of my friends went off to be mechanics, and I interviewed or talked to some mechanics and stuff like that to find out if that's what I wanted to do.
That's a smart move, by the way.
That's what I wanted to do.
Really smart though, for you to like go, not to cut you off, but like to ask people who are in it to be like, do you really like this? Cause who knows, you might've been like, go there and be like, oh, this sucks actually.
Yeah. And a lot of them enjoyed it, but the general consensus I had from them was they never had time to work on their own cars, or they never felt like coming home and
working
on their own
stuff. That's a thing. It's a real thing.
That kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, well, that doesn't sound fun. The whole reason I want to be a mechanic is because I want to work on cool stuff, right? So I decided to go to school to be an architectural technologist, which is drafting using AutoCAD and Revit to design buildings. So you mostly work for architects. You're the guy doing all the work while the architect's getting all the credit.
Okay. I see how it is.
Blood, sweat, and tears, hey?
The truth comes out. Yeah. Hot exclusive right here, folks. Breaking news.
So... Yeah, so that's So typically here in Alberta, you can go to NAIT or SAIT and take their architectural technologist program, which is a 2-year program. Yeah, so I did that. I went to NAIT myself. And then right after that, I started working at the company I work for now. So Eagle Builders.
Oh, wow.
And that was almost 12 years ago now.
Jeez.
That I started working for them.
That's so now cool. Strictly building, like, would it be residential, commercial? What kind of stuff do you, or a little bit of everything?
When I started there, we mostly did agricultural. So we did a lot of dairy farms and stuff.
Oh, interesting.
But I'd say like 6 to 8 months into me being there, we started stepping into a lot of commercial stuff and then got into a lot of commercial and industrial. And then we do a lot of everything now. So multi-residential towers, industrial complexes, all that kind of stuff. So,
wow. That's what it's something I've always wanted to. I've been tied to the design side of, you know, when you look at, like, when we bought our house, we had our big binder with everything, the floor plans and everything. I've always been tied to the design side.
Right.
But for me, the AutoCAD and all that stuff, you know, it takes a long time to figure out on your own when you're not, you know, getting trained or going to school for it. But the design side is just so cool because with the creativity. So you have to work with probably codes. Like building code and all that stuff when you design?
Yeah, building codes, bylaws, city officials and all that kind of stuff as well. Yeah.
Wow. So you have to know quite a bit of stuff to, you know, draw a building because you got to have, you know, with even, I'm just thinking from a carpentry or construction background, codes of, you know, commercial to residential is probably way different. And you got to have a lot of background skill sets to be able to, before you can even just start drawing in those programs, right?
Yeah. So, I'll just put it like, I did my 2 years of schooling, and then when I went to work, that's when the education really started.
I feel like that's. I feel like that is what happens to a lot of people.
I bought my first building code when I was in school, which is a binder with like 500 pages. I don't even know, probably even more than that, but it was a $300, like basically textbook, but it's something you had to have. Now you can get them online for free. Fortunately, it wasn't like that when I started school, but.
So that was just like the whole code, like the building code.
Yeah. The Bible.
Yeah. Okay.
Did that take a while to learn and you have to study that to be able, because I'm sure you have to know all those codes before, you're designing.
Yeah. So like it's a constant tool we use. Like it's so nice having it on the computer nowadays because you can search for keywords and have the clauses and stuff all pop up automatically for you. But, you know, having the binder on your desk was something that it was a regular part of your day, was continuously researching stuff and trying to find, I wouldn't say loopholes, but you know, how to get around certain issues or problems or stuff that came up. So
was that a big learning
curve?
Yeah,
it's something that I still learn. Sorry?
Was that a big learning curve for you when you got
big
started?
Big learning curve.
Because I didn't even know going to school with some carpenters in BCIT in Burnaby and electricians, like the code books, that those guys are scared of that sometimes when they get into their second and third year, when they really start diving in and they're like, we've got our IP and we have this 600-700 page document that we need to know in and out of where to find it. You know, the information's there, but being able to know where to find it, that's probably the hard part.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's not, honestly, it's not about what you know, it's about knowing where to look.
I guess the searching now, stuff. Searching online is probably a big time saver instead of flipping through pages.
It is. Yeah. And you do a lot of that stuff when you're going back and forth with city officials for permits and stuff like that. But yeah.
Is there an electric side? Like, do you have to deal with any electrical codes, or is it more just building? Like construction.
So for myself, I mostly deal with building code.
Okay.
With the buildings that I work on, we always have an electrical engineer, a mechanical engineer, an energy code specialist, a structural engineer, an architect. All of those are on the team, say, to make sure the whole building is being designed properly into code.
Yeah.
Before we start construction. So.
Wow.
That is, wow. That like, I'm overwhelmed just listening to this.
Overwhelmed on the design part, but then you bring the code stuff in that you're, it's kind of like a.
You make this like Taj Mahal. This is the best design. Yeah, you can't do that. That's over. That needs to be 5 feet over, and that's too close to this, and this is too close to the thing, and the whatever. Oh my gosh! Yeah. What was one hard lesson you learned? Like when you were like, have you ever designed something that you completely had to scrap because I forgot about that code or. I forgot about this, or I didn't talk to this engineer. Like, that'd be my life.
That, it didn't get scrapped, but I can't remember which project it was. But we were just kind of getting into some bigger projects, like square footage wise, larger. And like I said, this was my first job out of school, so I didn't know the code all that well. I knew quite a bit about what our typical projects were dealing with because we had done it so much. But this project in particular, we went in for permits or, you know, that kind of stuff. And then came back that we needed, an elevator, in the building and, to do with, barrier free requirements. So people could get up to the second floor and stuff, which totally makes sense. Now it's something we push hard for, but, back then we hadn't dealt with anything that big before. Mm-hmm. And, so the big thing in our company at Eagle Builders was that they don't charge extras. They don't bill extras for anything that, you know, we mess up on or that we do. So that was $60,000 oopsie daisy learning mistake that we made, that I made on a project that we had to eat in order to finish the building. But
oof. You know, see. Hey, I guess you learned.
Yeah. Never missed an elevator again, I'll tell you that.
Tell you that for free. Yeah. You're never gonna miss that one.
Yeah, that was pretty early on in the days. That was probably like a year or so into be working at Eagle Builders. So
wow. How is the technology side of, you know, AutoCAD? I'm not sure, you mentioned Revit. I've kind of dabbled a little bit into that stuff with school, but how is the technology advanced over, you know, 12, 13 years? Is it fairly user-friendly? Is it improving lots, making it easier for you to do your job? Can you talk a little bit about the technology side or with the software that you're using?
Yeah, so at the company I work for, we use Revit mostly, which is BIM, building information modeling. So everything's in 3D. Everything has information attached to it. Like your walls are modeled as the specific wall construction they need to be, your roofs same way, floors same way. That's mainly what we use now, and then we use a program called Enscape to do our renders, and we play around with Google SketchUp and stuff as well for some of our preliminary stuff. When I started there though, we were using AutoCAD, just regular AutoCAD at the time, and me, just because that's the way I learned and that's how what I grew up on it, I loved using AutoCAD. I would say everyone at work always makes fun of me for saying it, but I think AutoCAD was faster. Just because you know, you're just drawing lines, so to put all those lines on paper, and you know, you had to do a little more thinking, you had to visualize it in 3D yourself to make sure everything lined up, making changes, you had to make them in every part of your drawing, whereas in Revit, you can make a change in the model and it changes on all your pages, right? Okay. I felt it was faster, but just my personal opinion. I eventually moved into a management position. So I didn't do very much drafting for a while. And then when I got back into drafting, we were full blown into Revit. So I had to jump in there and learn, and I've missed AutoCAD ever since, but Revit is an awesome program. So
Now, did you use AutoCAD when you were in high school with design studies? Is that where that background came from?
So I learned AutoCAD in design studies in high school. A lot of my drafting at NEET was either hand sketched or AutoCAD. Mm-hmm. And we had one Revit course at the time that I took. And even our instructor wasn't very familiar with Revit. So,
So I want to hear, because since we have this partnership now with Grind Coffee, we're starting to highlight people's grind time stories. And that's like a time when you persevered through some adversity, when something was, you know, really sucked, but you got through it, and or some sort of time when you needed to. And so this can either be, you know, what we talked about earlier when we had our meeting, or it could be something within specifically, you know, your architectural technology experience. What was a time in your career, in your life, in your story where you had to persevere through something that really sucked at the time, but you got through it?
Yeah, so this could be a bit of a long story, but
we're here.
yeah. So about 3 or 4 years ago, I went through some pretty severe mental issues in my life. And knowing what I know now, a lot of it was due to work stress. But I didn't know that at the time. So I had been going through pretty severe migraines. And I would have them, you know, once a month, once every 2 months or so. Nothing too bad, didn't overly affect my life. But there came to a point where I started getting them once a week, and then twice a week, and then I was getting them every day, and then they were just constant. So I got diagnosed with chronic migraines. I ended up taking a ton of time off work. So I basically went on short-term disability leave from my job. And I went to so many hospital visits and everything like that, trying to figure out, you know, what was going on to cause me all this pain and these migraines and stuff. I was several months into this constant migraine when we started to realize that I might have been stressed out or had some anxiety to do with work. So started seeing a therapist and talking through these issues. And that's where we landed on the fact that I have struggled with an anxiety disorder for most of my life, and also some depression, which runs in my family, which wasn't something we really talked about until I went through all this and then found out that, yeah, this was something that ran in the family. So I went through all that. At the time, right before all this happened, I was, the company had grown so fast. When I started working at Eagle Builders, it was 3 drafters and a manager. That was all that was there. And we just did tickets for the precast panels that they produced mainly. Shortly into that, started drafting architectural plans for them. And I was the only one doing that. And then throughout the years, I grew into a team where there was about 20 of us drawing architectural plans. And I was managing them and all of the projects at the same time. So it was, constant work. I was there from 5 to 6 a.m. till 7 p.m. at night. I was on the phone. After that, I was on the phone on weekends. You know, work was constantly on my mind. It was something I was always doing. Taking trips out to BC and Manitoba and Toronto and stuff like that to meet with clients. And so it was a lot. It was a lot of work. The way the company had succeeded so quickly, there was a lot of weight on everybody in the company's shoulders, and there was a lot of expectations on each individual to excel and exceed and get stuff done. And I fell hard into that that trap, and it did get the best of me for sure, caught up to me really quickly. So I did end up going back to work with the same company, but I stepped down to just what we call a senior drafting position. But basically I'm just drafting again. So I'm not managing a team. I'm not managing projects. I'm not chasing down permits, making sure buildings are, you know, being built on time or anything like that. I'm just drafting my projects, designing buildings. So that cut down a lot of the stress in my life.
Did you have kids at that point?
Yes, we had our oldest for sure, and our second one was fairly young at the time.
So not to mention all the stuff going on at work, you also had a family.
Did. And we were also renovating a house at the time too. We had bought a 100-year-old house and I was it's rebuilding like, why not? It. We had to get it done in time for the kids.
And... Makes sense. Yeah, yeah. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So like what motivated you to, because a lot of times, and I can speak, like I have an anxiety disorder as well, diagnosed 6-8 years now. And like it, at the time when you first get that diagnosis, like it's after the dust settled for me, because after it was like, it was ADHD and generalized anxiety. And I really like took it hard because I was like, what? Because there's a stigma, right? There's like, there's a stigma attached to all that stuff. And I took it hard. And then all of a sudden I figured out, oh, wait a second. I just know how my brain works. I'm just learning how my brain works. And that's cool. And
exactly.
Everything up until this point that I thought was just how things were, it doesn't have to be that way. And so then there's, you know, I'm like, well, I woke up with like a tightness in my chest every morning. I just thought that was normal. And everyone had that, and that's okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
But like, it would have been easy for you once you got, when you're going through all this stuff, especially with the depression, I'm sure. I'm sure it would have been easy for you to be like, you know what, screw it, and turn to the bottle or turn to some other way of coping. What was a big driving force that motivated you to like overcome this, or not necessarily overcome, because you know you would live with this for the rest of your life. But
yes,
to get through it and to, or to figure out strategies, like what was, because when you're in that pit, like I know exactly when you're lying in bed and you don't want to get out of bed because you don't want to face the world because there's all this crap out there that you don't want, like I can see, I've been there 100%. And what, at that moment when you're like down in the pit, what was your like, no, I have to get up. Like, what was that? What made you do that?
Yeah. Honestly, it was my family. Mm-hmm. It was my kids. I fell hard. I was in bed because of my migraines and stuff for months at a time. I had thoughts of suicide because of the pain that I was in and what I was putting my family through. And you know, I just had this overwhelming feeling of they would all be better off without me kind of thing. But it was my family and my kids that helped me overcome that and realize, you know, I haven't been here for the last several years because I've been working my ass off nonstop. I haven't been enjoying the whole reason why I'm here, being with my kids and my wife and doing the things that we enjoy and our hobbies and stuff. And it was then that I knew, you know, I can't leave them behind, for one. That's not an option. And I needed to be happy and there for them. And that's what gave me the push to finally get the help that I needed and, you know, get on the right medication and, be there, be present.
Be present. That's a big one. Hey, I think lots of people can get so tied up in that work, the work. If you have that strong work ethic and you don't want to, it sounds like when you're going through, you know, those few years of just grinding it out all the time, you weren't going to say no until, or you weren't going to stop work until you were happy. And sometimes that can take you till, you know, 10, 11 at night. Not seeing your family, missing out on stuff because you, that, whether it's perfectionist or just that work ethic of I'm doing this job, I'm doing it to the best of my abilities, and everything else just kind of almost fades away, right? You're just so focused on that. And it's interesting too how that mindset can start having a physical toll on your body from the migraines, you know, that stress. People think of stress as, you know, internal, but we hear more and more and you see more and more that it manifests into, or I shouldn't say it does, but it can manifest into, you know, your body physically shutting down or having this stuff and trying to, you know, put up with. I mean, my wife gets migraines every once in a while and they can be devastating. So to hear you having them, you know, 2-3 times a week every day, that's mind blowing that you could still function and, you know, put yourself through the grind of working all the time. Like, man, that's nuts. That just blows me, blows my mind away that you could put up with that and still be able to focus. You know, you're on a computer designing and stuff, you know, probably not the best for, you know, light and stuff, that sensitivity. That's just, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it was all the time. It was nonstop. I, you know, I was the guy who didn't take vacations, you know, like, you know, no, I'm dedicated to the company. I'm going to get everything done. I'm, you know, I never took my vacations. I worked nonstop. And yeah, then I realized that just wasn't the way. It was that whole, you know, man up.
Mm.
That's the,
yeah,
that's the thing I always tie back to. There's this whole stigma, you know, I'm not necessarily in the trades, but trades adjacent. And there's this whole, you know, I'm friends with a lot of the site supers and stuff like that at the company. And there's this whole, you know, man up, mentality, you know, where you can't show weakness. You can't show, you know, that you need to take time off to spend time with your family. You know, you gotta man up and do it and make money for your household and,
and don't show your
that
feelings kind
of stuff. And that man up.
Yeah.
Yeah. The man up, mentality is what gets, you know, men in so much trouble. Like, to man up and hide your feelings and all this stuff. That's what makes it get built up inside of you and pent up all these emotions and feelings. And that's why there's such a high suicide rate in men too, is this man up. You know, it's not cool to go see a therapist, and you know, you're not manly if you're not working 80 hours a week or 100 hours a week or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just,
well, then you mentioned too, that you didn't, you know, when you were growing up or you found that depression was in your family, you didn't talk about your feelings. I'm kind of the same way. Like, I don't know. I didn't really talk about feelings with my dad or, you know, any male figure in my family. It was just kind of, you know, I don't think I ever saw my dad cry. And, you know, it sets this bar and that's just what you grew up with. So it's, you know, you're almost quote unquote manning up just on who you're around. And then,
well, it's all, you know,
you get into life and, you know, certain things happen. I remember the first time I went and saw a psychologist, it was mind blowing that somebody's here to listen and say, it's okay to feel that way. Like these are emotions. These are, you know, you should be feeling like this with what's going on. And just kind of like,
and not call you a little bee.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like it's okay to feel that way and to show emotion and to say you need help and talk about these things. And it's just, I don't know how to get that stigma under control. I feel like it could be maybe somewhat generational. You know, the people that were, you know, born in the 50s, 60s, they were just, they had that mentality, that grind mentality and man up for probably their whole life. You know, so how do you go from somebody who doesn't maybe talk about your emotions and, you know, that touchy feely subject, and now you have kids and you don't, you know, like it's just almost a revolving door of, of all this stuff. And I mean, it sucks that there's so many people going through that and afraid to, you know, and even telling their spouse how they feel, you know, they're just hiding everything. And over time that builds up. And a lot of times I think it can turn into, you know, you talked about suicide, there's the physical side. People are, you know, it seems like now more than ever, people are passing away from, you know, complications and stuff, and how much of that can be rooted into a stress or anxiety that they've been holding for decades, you know?
Yeah. Disease. Yeah.
Exactly. And how many doctor's visits that I had to go through before, you know, doctor's visits and hospital visits and tests and all this kind of stuff before finding out that what I was going through was, you know, mental illness. It was anxiety and depression and stress, and that's what was taking its toll on me. It's this, when I started opening up about what I went through and talking with like coworkers and people in the construction industry that were my friends and stuff like that at the time, it was amazing how many of them I found out were also struggling, but were too afraid to talk about it or weren't talking about it. You know, they were just trying to deal with it on their own, which is what I had done for so long. Everyone knew me as the guy who didn't get stressed out. You know, I was chill. I was just always working, getting my stuff done. You know, I was never mad. I was never upset. I just you know, got it done. I was just there and did it. And secretly inside, I mean, I didn't even realize it, but I was stressed out.
Wow. Yeah,
I didn't even recognize that as stress for the longest time. I kept saying, I'm not stressed out. I'm just busy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. as a hiding mechanism, or just that's what you're used to, right? You're just,
or you just didn't even know any better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then your brain starts shutting off and you're like, maybe I should do something about this.
Jeez. Exactly. Yeah.
Did you, when you started seeing or seeking help, did you receive any pushback from anybody? Or was it supportive for the most part?
Everyone was very supportive. When I started getting help, I had distanced myself from work substantially. So I didn't have any conversations with anybody from the office or the company or anything like that. Not that they would have pushed back. Everyone was super supportive when I came back. Mm-hmm. But everyone in my life was super supportive. And that's, you know, when you start going through that and you start talking about what's happening to you and what you're trying to do, that's when you start hearing everybody else's stories. And it's like, well, why didn't you tell me about this before? I might've known what I was going through.
Mm-hmm. Almost inspire other people too, to maybe, hey, you know what? I'm not feeling right. I should go talk to somebody or try and get some help. And then, you know, exactly. You might've inspired some people just within at your company that you work for to go seek help to, you know, to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think, I know just speaking from experience though, because a lot of times it's a chemical imbalance in our brains or whatever. Right. And so I got on anxiety medication or ADHD. I forget which one it was. And the next morning I woke up and I didn't have this like dread feeling. And I was like, whoa, what? And I was like, this is not normal for me, but this is normal. This is what normal feels like. And I was sharing with my wife, like how I was feeling that morning. And I like broke down. Cause I was like, I felt so relieved. It just, the weight was lifted and I'm just like, oh my gosh. And dealing, you know, like going to getting strategies and hearing things like worry is a down payment on something that you may never, ever see. And
exactly
answer the what ifs and all these different strategies to talk yourself out of, like, you know, spinning your tires and perseverating on things. But when you realize, like, I went my whole life thinking that how I was feeling was just how people felt. Because I never felt
that's
any
what I thought too.
I didn't feel any different.
You're supposed to have a pit in your stomach at every moment of the day.
Yeah, that's
and
just
have all these fake conversations and scenarios that play out.
Yeah.
So you're prepared in case, you know, somebody wants to argue with you or thinks you did something wrong or whatever.
Or if you on your way to work, you accidentally, you know, sideswipe someone or run into someone and then you're there, but then you're going to miss work. And then what if you're late for work? Cause there's that meeting and you get fired. And then
almost preparing for worst case scenario.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely.
Constantly.
And,
that's, you know, where that's where you live is in that worst case.
Yeah. You play through hundreds of scenarios in your head
and then you find an even worse one.
99% of them bad.
Yeah. And none of them, it's an absolute worst. None of them going to happen.
None of them would ever happen. No,
ever. But no, you're there and you're like, you're convinced. You convince yourself that that's what is going to happen.
When I started on the medication, like you said, to wake up in the morning or to sleep through the night for one, and then to wake up in the morning and not have that pit in my stomach about what all's going to happen that day. And then also just not to have 100 scenarios running through my brain all the time.
Oh,
such a relief.
Game changer.
And it's that moment of awe. Like this is how, you know, most people think and feel in a day.
And it's weird being like, do you ever feel like an imposter where it's like, I can, cause I work with a bunch, I'm a teacher. I work with a lot of educated, very intelligent people. And I just assume, which is not necessarily true, but that none of them are dealing with any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'm coming out and I'm thinking this and that. And then like some of them can't relate at all to me constantly losing my keys or constantly forgetting this and that. And I used to chalk it up to me being just like, I'm just an unorganized person or I'm a bad teacher because teachers are planned out well and they're organized and blah, blah, blah. Well, no, I have this thing wrong with my brain. Or no, not even wrong. I'm just neurodivergent. I'm not the same. My brain is not the same as yours. And then yeah. I don't have, there's freedom in that, in knowing that I don't have to live up to what the, what I think they think I should be like, or what I think they're like. But, you know, chances are they're not like that. Chances are they're dealing with crap too, and then but they're just playing it off really well. You know what I mean?
Either they're getting really good help, or they're putting it off and letting it compound, and right?
Yeah, there's this thing you hear all the time nowadays where it's like, oh, everybody has an anxiety disorder, or everybody has ADHD. And it's like, yes, there are a lot of people who have it, but it's just because we're able to diagnose it now. People are able to recognize it better now and be medicated for it or treated for it or go to therapy for it. They didn't do that back then. It's not that everybody has it nowadays because that's society. It's that we're able to recognize it and try to help with it. Mm-hmm.
I think too with kids, like I think not, I do think there's a little bit to that as far as like the trendiness of it, right? Like just like, gluten-free, like I have a gluten allergy, but then there's people who are like, because it's a trend, they're like, I'm gluten-free, are you allergic to gluten? No.
Yeah.
I just eat gluten-free. It's like, okay. But like, I do, I got into it a little bit with someone, this is last year, the year before last, and we were chatting, and we were at this conference, and this person was like, kind of complaining about anxiety and people that they work with and how it's just all bullshit and they're just making stuff up and we got to do all these things and accommodate blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, tell me why you think that. And then he kind of went off. And then I was like, interesting. Well, it's not bullshit. And I pulled up my diagnosis from a registered psychologist. I was like, I actually have this disorder that you're talking about. And I just kind of, I didn't let him have it, but I was like, I struggle with this every single day. I have to take medication for it. There are times when I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. It's not just because I'm trying to get an easy way out. You prick. Like I was so mad. Good thing it wasn't someone that I like, know. It was like in a group. I don't know, whatever. But, Do you find that, does that happen to you too, where some people, especially in your industry, where people are like, are you vocal about it? And if you are, do you get some like, really? Or do you still feel out there? Like if you're not vocal about it and you're kind of just listening to people talking about like this new epidemic of anxiety or whatever it is. Do you find yourself having to be a bit of an advocate, or are you just kind of like, wow, you need to read a book, or you know what I mean?
I'm typically pretty open about what I went through and about my anxiety and stuff, just because, it's hard to talk about. I'm a shy person. I don't strike up conversations with everybody I meet, but I try to talk about it, you know, when it's appropriate, just to help raise awareness, because I know that if somebody had talked about it when I was going through what I was going through, it might have been something I recognized to myself and then would have been able to start treating it sooner. But it's when I don't talk about it, you know, when the conversation starts going that way, that's when you start hearing this anxiety epidemic, everyone's, you know, making it up and just trying to get attention. And
just trying to get attention. Well, I'm sure there are people who are taking it for granted. Or taking advantage of it, I mean.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just I like mean, with everything.
Like with anything in life, but yeah.
So, okay, this is, so what was, how can you, okay, first of all, I think it's important to say, if you're listening to this right now, and anything that we're saying, anything that Brian shared, anything that I've shared, anything that Corey said, kind of rings true, and you're struggling with this and you're considering different choices that you might not be the best for you, please seek help. I'm going to post some phone numbers you could call, some resources in the show notes of this episode. And please seek out, reach out, whatever you're not alone. How you're feeling is not one-off. You're not the only person that happened to have this in the entire world, and you're not by yourself dealing with this stuff. It's difficult, but you don't have to do it alone, and there's hope, and you can get through it. Please do not give up. Please call these numbers. I'm going to put like some hotlines that you can call and some different resources that you can access. Please do that. And you're not alone. You're not alone. Please know that. I needed
yeah,
to say
that. And maybe
that.
I'll just add in here too. Like, yeah. When I realized that it was stress and that there might be something going on mentally, and I was in tears or whatever it was going through something that day, I didn't know how to start. I didn't know how to talk to a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a therapist or anything like that. I didn't know where to go. I went to my local walk-in clinic.
Okay.
And I talked to the doctor there. And I said, this is what I'm dealing with. I think I need to talk to somebody. And they put me in touch with a therapist. If you're worried about costs or whatever, because that's not necessarily something that's covered by Alberta Health. If you talk to a doctor and you get a recommendation, then you're not paying for it. Mm. And I don't even know if you would have to pay for it either way. But I haven't paid for any therapy or any psychologist. It's all been covered by the Alberta Health. And I've taken free online group therapy courses that we met once a week and talked about anxiety and cognitive brain therapy and how to deal with it and how to learn from it. And all that was also free.
Love it.
And once you start reaching out for help, there is a lot of help out there. And nobody that you reach out to with those issues is going to make fun of you or turn you down or turn you away or minimize what you're feeling.
Because whether their feelings aren't right or wrong, they just are how you're feeling, and we got to figure out
exactly
why. Yeah.
And talking to people is the that first and foremost, probably the most important part of that, right? Being it ready is. To talk about and discuss, even though it might bring up a lot of, you know, sensitive stuff and stuff that's been maybe put aside for many years. But I think that, you know, probably as you could probably attest to, opening up to somebody, whether, you know, mental health, you know, something's happened, trauma, whatnot, is probably the most, can be one of the most freeing. Mm-hmm. That rock is off your shoulders and you can kind of breathe. And that's where the therapy and that's the beginning of the journey, right? To be able to
exactly
help yourself. So
yeah, therapy changed
and since
my
I
life.
Started going to therapy, my wife has started therapy, my oldest daughter, I started seeing some signs of anxiety and stuff and her behavior. Not saying that anything will come of that, but you know, we got the number for a child therapist and all that kind of stuff for her too, just in case, you know, she needs some help. But I've talked to her about, you know, writing in a journal and that kind of stuff to help her with her thoughts of anxiety and the stuff that she's dealing with and going through and stuff that I learned from those courses that I took.
Yeah. And I mean, here's three people in the trades that have gone to therapy.
Yep.
On this show right now. Don't mean to out you there.
Oh, no. I said.
you're like, I'm very
I'm just trying to do math.
Yeah. He's like, one, two. No, but like, and it's, it'll change your life, like, for the better. It's tough. No one likes, well, shouldn't say no one. I love going there. I don't know why. None of my buddies can relate. They don't like, I'm like, well, maybe you a little bit. You like talking about stuff, Huff. Yeah. Huff and I talk about our feelings quite often.
But that's also another important thing is to have a friend, you know, it might be a colleague, it could be a best friend, somebody that you can just know judgment and, you know, that like you were saying, that's not going to, you know, shame you on sharing your feelings, but to have somebody where you can be like, hey, this is what I'm going through. And just to have open ears, unbiased, you know, just listening. That's the big thing is, personal experience for me, you know, going to or working up the self-esteem to go to a psychologist, I was afraid of that. Oh, well, you know, but they're there to listen. And, you know, as a friend, if you can, if, you know, if somebody's going through something hard, just just listen to them. You know, you don't have to talk. You don't have to say anything.
Yeah.
My wife tells me this all the time. She's a psychologist. She's like, you know.
Because of her professionally.
But just that, you know.
Quit offering me advice. Yeah. Just listen.
Whether you're talking with your spouse, a friend, you know, sometimes just less is better of just shutting up and hearing somebody out and, you know, that's all they need.
When either of us gets a phone call about 3:15, 3:30, when I get a call from Hoff or when he gets a call from me, we know exactly what it is. We had a crappy day at work. Something went down, and it's like, hey man, I need to bounce something off you, and it's great. I appreciate that.
And
it's awesome. So yeah, find someone that you can do that to for sure. They just that
preferably a professional if you're really struggling and
of course.
But sometimes that little heated vent session, sometimes what we call them, you know, haven't been able to talk for 5 minutes. I can go home and it's off my chest. I don't have to worry about bringing it around my kids, my family, you know, trying to leave that stuff out so you can enjoy and enjoy your family, be present when you're at home instead of, you know, trying to come down or have a conversation. That's another big thing is people taking their stuff home and not being able to
and your head's at work
with it. Yeah.
Hey, your head's at work.
Exactly.
And
I go back and watch some videos and family videos and stuff like that of us at home, me hanging out with the girls when they were really little and stuff like that. And, you know, my wife remembers that that was a fun evening or whatever, but I look at it and I can see it in myself. It's like, I mentally wasn't there. I can tell.
Wow.
It's like, I was thinking about work and I can tell I was not doing good at that moment. Like, yeah, this is a happy memory for everyone else. But if you really look at me, I'm not there. I'm not present.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah. And totally.
How many people go through life without recognizing that?
Yeah.
That's the other thing, right? I'm sure there's a lot of people that go through, that's they're grinding day in, day out for their whole career. And maybe it might be, you know, when they retire or something happens and to look back and not say, oh, I should have had some help or talked to somebody and maybe this could have been different and I could have been present and, you know, a better father or mother, you know, like around my kids and family.
Exactly.
There's a lot of people that I think go through and just coast on that autopilot because that's all they know and they don't seek to find any help.
Nobody's going to be on their deathbed and be like, look back on their life and say, oh, I wish I would have worked more.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. And not to like guilt anybody, but like I heard something, I don't know if I saw it on Instagram or something, but it'll say like your kids might not remember how often you were there, but they'll remember the times you weren't.
Exactly.
Right? Hey, I had this big game and I scored my first goal or I did all that. You weren't there. They won't necessarily remember how often you were because that's just what you're supposed to be doing. But they'll definitely remember when you weren't.
Yep.
And I was like, ooh.
Even being present at that stuff, because now with mobile devices and all this stuff, how easy is it to work off your phone? You know, taking my kids to swimming lessons and the odd time, you know, kind of check something, but I want to watch them. You know, you want to be present in that moment.
Yeah.
How many people are, I've seen some parents with their laptops in the pool and I'm like, oh, you know, and teach their own, you know, sometimes there's that job that has to be done and, you know, that balance is hard, but I don't know. It makes you almost, you know, and then if different things happen as, you know, as you grow up and life events happen and you're kind of like, oh, I need to just shut this down. I'm with my kids. You know, this can wait. Easier said than done maybe for some people in different professions, you know, but I don't know. That's a tricky 100%. One.
Nowadays, like I don't have my work email on my phone. I don't give out my cell phone number to coworkers or clients or anything like that. Like I just... When I'm home, I'm home. I mean, one of the things I guess we're going to get into is like, once I started feeling better and I was on medication and back on track, the therapist I was going to see said like to, you know, do more of my hobbies, my fun stuff, the stuff that I enjoy. So I got back into my cars and my hobbies and stuff like that. And I don't know, maybe being a bit of a workaholic, I also turned it into a business, but I really enjoy doing it now.
But see, I think when you enjoy it, that is a different, I think the fulfillment and the enjoyment of a job, a profession, when you enjoy something, I think you look at it differently. You can you can put it away while you're at your kid's birthday party or dance lessons and enjoy it, enjoy the moment, and then you can go back to it. Whereas sometimes if you hate it, you're just like, I got to get this freaking work done. You know, it's going to take me 12 hours. I can't take a break. I'll, you know, look up the odd time. But I feel like if you enjoy something, work is just that, that mental shift is enlightening.
It is. Yeah, definitely.
I was at, now when you talk about like taking your kids to stuff, whatever, I started taking my kids to Taekwondo. They're actually registered and participating. We're not just sitting there watching people like creeps. Just take them.
Yeah.
Hey, this is what Taekwondo is. Wow, that looks like fun, Dad. No, so they're in Taekwondo, and the time blocks like my son's before, and then for an hour, my daughter's for 45 minutes after. And so I'm there with for two blocks, and each time I'm sitting beside a different, like one of my kids is beside me. Each time. And the first time I was like, this is kind of funny because I was on my phone and I'm trying to get some guests lined up and I'm trying to, you know, do whatever. And then I'm like, the next time we come back, I'm sitting there and I'm looking around and I see all these parents on their phones. And then their kids that they're waiting, like younger brothers, sisters, whatever, they're on like their own like iPads and no one's connecting and everyone's just kind of in their own little zone. And almost like that movie WALL-E when everyone's just kind of like floating around on their carts. Yeah. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my gosh, what would I think? And I do this sometimes. I'm like, if I was my son and my dad was on the chair and I'm trying my best to grow in this skill set and I look up and my dad's not
face
looking
down
at,
and something.
Yeah, not looking at me, even if it's a book, right? Whatever. Not looking at me, cheering me on, whatever. Okay, whatever, keep going, look up again. Still not.
It's the biggest gut punch, hey, when you realize that. Sometimes you catch yourself and you're like, oh, what am I doing? You put it away.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the next time you might look at somebody, oh, they're selfish, you know, but you're like, I was doing that last week.
That's exactly what I did. And then I'm like, oh, I'm going to show these parents so the next week. I took my phone and I set it on the floor in front of me or under my seat and I just sat and watched. And the a-hole side of me was like, yeah. And then I'm like, don't be an idiot. Like, I'm such a good dad. Yeah. I'm watching. You know, my ego starts flaring up a little bit and I'm like, no, you're not a good dad. You did that last week. I mean, I'm not a bad dad.
Exactly.
But I'm a hypocrite too because I did it last week. But I'm really gonna try to like do that every week because my son he'll do like a part of his pattern or whatever, and then he'll kind of look back, and I'll smile and he'll kind of smirk and then he'll keep going. You know, that's beautiful connection. And same with my daughter, right? She'll come around and like she'll smile, wave, whatever. Like I would have missed all that if I was in my phone. Who cares? All that's gonna be there. And I did the same thing. I took notifications off for my work email. Our school division is actually super awesome where they have this policy called right to disconnect or something like that, where they've messaged out to parents and they've actually, it's like a unwritten rule, I guess. You don't send an email past 6 o'clock, like 6 to 6 or 6 to 6:30, 6 to 7, whatever it is. But after 6 o'clock, you know, unless it's like an emergency, like someone in the community has passed away or something, they don't send, my principal doesn't send anything until like Sunday night at 5:30 for like the week at a glance thing. Mm. And they're super good about that. Even texts and stuff, like we have this like right to disconnect and my principal won't contact us at all. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Because you could fill up your life answering emails and texts. Anyways.
Yeah.
So how can we get back to the stigma? Last question about that, and then we'll move into the mag. But how can we work against this stigma? What can we do to like, and we're just, you know, spoiler alert, I have a mental health workplace, mental health expert who also is an expert of mental health in the trades. Have him lined up and we're going to have him on. Pretty sweet. So we're going to dive into this even more. the mental health piece and the stigma. But from your perspective, Brian, what can we do as individuals to try to get rid of the stigma?
To talk about it. I think that's the biggest thing, is to have it be, you know, part of normal conversation, not be something that's shunned away or secretly talked about or whatever, like to open up about these experiences with people and just share, because it's the only way it's going to be, you know, part of everyday life, and people realize what's going on and people see it in themselves as if it's part of everyday conversation. If you're not seeing it or hearing about it, then you're never going to know until it's too late.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%. So you're in therapy. Yeah. Your therapist is like, hey, mine did that same thing. What do you like to do? You should do more of that. No shit.
Yeah.
Why didn't I think of that myself? Yeah. You should do things that bring you joy. You're not joyful.
We're allowed to do,
do
that?
Things that bring you joy. So what were they? And you kind of alluded
what
to it a little bit. Yeah. How did that go? And what are you working on now? And how are we working together, perhaps?
Sounds good, yeah. So I started in 2020, I started Cruise Culture Apparel. So, like I said, my therapist told me to get back into my hobbies and do stuff that I enjoy. So I got back into my cars. I've got a 1955 Buick Special that I'm building right now.
Sweet.
Yeah, that one's on my YouTube channel, going through all the steps with it.
We'll link to that in the show notes.
And then I've also got a 1964 Oldsmobile Super 8 that I call Los Viejos. That's on air and stuff like that. I bought that one because I wanted a car that was already running that I could use and drive and enjoy while I was building the 55. Because I was like, if I'm getting it into this hobby, I'm getting all the way into it. So, I mean, I did end up taking that one apart, putting air ride and rebuilding the engine and stuff like that in the Oldsmobile. And it's super reliable. I drive it almost every day. I love driving it around all the time. And I'm not going to be the guy who wears golf shirts everywhere, because that's what dress code was at work. So I, you know, started getting t-shirts and stuff again. And I had a hard time finding t-shirts that I liked and that fit, you know, with cars and stuff on them. And so I started doing research into, you know, how can I make my own car t-shirts? I've always been, you know, into art and drawing cars and stuff as well. So I was like, you know what, on the side, I'm just going to start drawing some stuff and putting them on t-shirts, and then I'll print them and sell them and see how it goes. And before you knew it, I was setting up at car shows with a booth and selling t-shirts and hats and stickers. And a big part of what I was doing at the time was, you know, because if you had a t-shirt with a Chevelle on it and people are like, ah, you know, if only it had a Mustang on it, I'd buy it. Or if only that Chevelle was blue, I'd buy it, or whatever. So I was like, you know what? It's not that hard for me to put one of these designs together. I was like, I'm just going to do custom designs for literally anybody that wants to put their car on a t-shirt. And started doing that. At the time, I was doing them for free because it was just like, you know, just, you know, make sure you buy a couple t-shirts so it's worth my time kind of thing. Somewhat worth my time, but it was something I enjoyed doing. And so that's where it started. It was like anybody could get their car on a t-shirt, you know. And I was pushing the t-shirts quite a bit and making a go of it for a couple years. And then I had this idea to put out a catalog. So a lot of the t-shirts I had done were obviously based off of real cars and trucks and stuff that were out there that people had built. So I was like, I'm going to put together a little catalog that showcases some of these cool trucks and cars, and then shows off the t-shirts and merchandise and stuff that people can buy. And started putting it together, hadn't even gotten that far into it. And lots of people started hearing about it, getting excited about it, possibly being a real print car magazine coming back, you know, because all those print magazines are leaving and not very many of them left that you can just go to the gas station and pick up or whatever. So there was a ton of excitement, and I right away got people who were like, can I advertise in your magazine? Can you feature my car in the magazine? And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna change this up. Instead of doing a catalog, let's try out this car magazine thing. Like worst case scenario, I put it on issue or two, and then I stop. And here we are, a year and a bit later, going strong. It's picking up with every issue, getting more and more orders, and everyone's just loving it.
Wow, isn't that cool?
That's sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, cruise culture.
Yeah. Cruise Culture Apparel, and then I started Cruise Culture Magazine to go with it. And then with that, I've also got the YouTube channel. So, funny story, actually. I'm not a photographer at all. My wife was a wedding photographer for a while.
Oh, cool.
So she had a bunch of the equipment. And I was set to shoot, this was for the second issue. It was Dale Kwas's Mazda B2200. And then I was also going to do a group shot with Forbidden Fantasy Mini Truck Club here in Central Alberta. And I had a photographer lined up, a good friend of mine, Miranda, MNK Photography out of Edmonton, was scheduled to come and shoot them for me. She ended up having a family emergency and she couldn't make it. But this was like the Forbidden Fantasy car show in Central Alberta. So like this was the only day I was going to make it work. So I called my wife. And I was like, okay, you're going to have to come to this car show and bring your camera, and you're going to have to try to take, I know you're a wedding photographer, but you're going to have to try to take pictures of cars. And she was super nervous and stuff. She's like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I take pictures of couples at weddings. Like, it's totally different. And I was like, okay, well, come and show me how to use the camera quick. And then I'm going to give it a whirl. You just got to stay close to me. So that way you can fix the camera if I mess something up. And yeah, I wound up shooting it, and it went really, really well. Like looking back now, I could have shot the club's shots a little better, but they still turned out good. The shots with Dale's truck turned out amazing. I was super happy with them, and I've been shooting for the magazine ever since. Miranda still shoots for me in every single issue. She's got a feature or two in every single one, but yeah, I started doing that, and then I decided, you know what, actually a friend of mine suggested, he's like, you should start a YouTube channel. And I was like, that's cool, but I'm too shy of a person. Like I don't want to be in front of the camera or doing anything like that. And he kept pushing. This was actually Dale, the guy who owned the red truck, kept pushing me to do it. And then another one of my really good friends, Dan Holtink here in Lacombe, he said, you know, we should get working on the 55 Buick again. And he's like, you should film that, put it on a YouTube channel, put it on your YouTube channel. Just do a build series on there. Like that's what lots of people are doing, and it's fun. There's no pressure, just do it. And so I was like, yeah, you know what, you're right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna start a YouTube channel to go along with it, and started filming some content on the 55 Buick build. And then when I was going out to do photo shoots, I was like, this is the perfect opportunity to, you know, shoot an interview for the YouTube channel, and you know, do some cool video shots of whatever vehicle I was shooting at the time, and some behind the scenes of the photography and stuff like that. And so, yeah, that's mostly what the YouTube channel is. Some show coverage, some coverage of the photo shoots, features on trucks, interviews, build series, everything.
That's wicked. That it almost brings me back to like the trucking days. I remember as a kid, those trucking magazines, right?
Yeah.
That hard copy where you could go to the gas station.
It's like an inch thick, that yeah, trucking magazine. Like,
oh,
hey, remember?
Man. How excited I would get on looking at the, and I was young, you know, probably, I don't know, 8, 10, all the way, you know, till middle school. Actually, I think sometimes my mom still gets me the, I don't know if they're trucking magazines, but in my stocking at Christmas, and there's something to be said about the physical, you know, a magazine. You know, everything's going digital, and you can do these Kindle e-readers, all
it's
this other crap. But when you get that physical magazine and you're looking through, and you know, you're going through a build or reading through an interview, you know, I don't know. It for me, it brings me so much joy to have a physical piece. And I'm like, I've still got magazines that I kept that I like the builds in them or whatnot, right? And it's just,
oh yeah, I still have tons.
I don't know. It's tangible, right? And you can you can keep it. And
there's
that
super gloss, gloss. Oh,
yeah,
I don't know.
That's awesome. Has that journey been, you know? How's that journey been like?
It's been absolutely incredible, and like I said, the response has been amazing. Everyone says the same thing, and it's mind blowing because everybody says it. Like, why did these print magazines die off? Like, why? Because everyone says the same thing. Everyone's saying, "I miss print magazines. I don't read online magazines." Same. I've never read an online magazine ever. I put my magazine out as an online version, for free, on my website, but you know. Not very many people go and read that. Everyone buys the print copy, orders the print copy because everyone wants the print copy. Like, everyone wants to hold it and read it. And so I sell the print magazine online and I print it to a really high quality, thick paper. You know, it's almost like a book. I've had a couple of people tell me it's almost like a book. Like, it's not just a magazine, it's almost like a book. The pages don't rip and, you know, disintegrate in your fingers or whatever. And yeah, it's a little more expensive than the magazines that are still on the shelves. Not that there's very many of them, but I mean, it's the real deal.
Now, how many issues is it? Monthly? Is it, you know, how many issues you said you mentioned you've been doing this for about a year and a half. So how many issues do you kind of shoot for, I guess that scheduling of them?
Yeah, so I do an issue every 2 months. So we just had our eighth issue come out here on October 1st. So did a little bit of a Halloween theme. We had a cool old Cadillac hearse lowrider featured in there, as well as a car that the guy named Frankenkoop. I think it was a 37 Ford or something like that that had
Yeah, I'm
been
looking at it
through
right
a
now.
tornado,
36
an
Ford.
F5 tornado.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Jeez.
36 Ford. Been through an F5 tornado, got wiped out, and then was in a garage fire. Got wiped out again, and then it's been rebuilt just in time for him and his dad to enjoy it together. But
Wow. Is
some
the is the
pretty
fun
cool
is the fun
features
finding
like that
these
in there.
builds and features? Like, do you have a lot of contacts, or are you grinding it out, you know, trying to find these builds and stuff and in
I'm
the
grinding it
communities?
out. I'm all over Instagram and online and going to car shows and talking to people. It's so cool how many photographers I've met, how many custom shop owners and stuff like that. I had no idea there were so many shops here in Alberta. I knew we had a good car scene here, but I never realized how many custom shops there are around, small custom shops and stuff that are doing some pretty incredible builds. And the contacts and stuff that I've made over the last year and the people that I've met has been amazing because, you know, everyone knows somebody else
Yeah, big
who's got
time.
something cool that you should go look at. And it's just like with every issue that I put out or everyone I talk to, I've there's five more contacts to go and talk to and see what they've got. And
Wow. Now, is this all Canadian builds, or do you go south of the border?
I've actually got a fair following from the States as well. So I don't go south of the border and take pictures, but I do have some people that submit vehicles and cars and pictures and stuff like that from the States. I've got lots of good friends down there. So every magazine started out as probably mostly Canadian content. I'd say right now we're about half and half, and that's kind of where I want to keep it. I want to make sure there's a lot of that Canadian content because it's stuff that people don't really get to see. Because I mean, print magazines don't really exist, but like Canadian print magazines really don't exist.
Yes,
There's only
exactly. What was
like one or
that?
two of them, right?
Canadian
So
Classic Cruisers or something like that? Wasn't that Canadian
wasn't that
Classic?
for
Yeah, there was
sale
one like
though?
that.
Like a classifieds one? Or
No,
was there a
there's like a Canadian classic Canadian car or something like that. But yeah, it
There's
was.
a Canadian hot rod out of BC. That
Okay.
guy does some. And then there's one out of Calgary too. Garage Shots magazine.
Oh, cool.
Oh, cool.
Those are the only two I know of. Yeah. And I think the guy who does Canadian hot rods also has one called Bone Stock. Bone
Nice.
Stock magazine. But
Wow. I
yeah.
just love the, I don't know, the, what do you call it? The brand, just the aesthetic, just, I
The
just,
creativity too.
yeah.
This is art, right? Like, not only the builds, but
Yeah.
the photos capturing everything. It's another medium that hooks. Like, we're just kind of going through the different episodes, and I'm like, wow, this is wicked. I want to get my hands on some of these because
Yeah.
just, you
So
know,
it's,
there's so much out
I
there.
have some people who are like, how do you pick what goes in the magazine? Like
Yeah,
what
that was my
are the
next
requirements? And
question.
I was like, there's not really any requirements. It's just whatever I think is cool.
Yeah.
This is what's
So
going to
you
line
have
up for me. I'm a big patina guy.
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a ton of patina stuff in there, and I like stuff that's low, so I put a lot of that in there. I've got a motorcycle, a custom motorcycle that's lined up to be in there. Pretty much the only requirement I have is that it's custom, like not just the stock, whatever. That stuff's cool, but you know, not necessarily for me. So
yeah,
but, or your yeah, audience for that.
Whatever
matter.
I think is cool. So.
You have the
exactly. Yeah,
creative freedom to be able to put what you think. Well, what you want to really, which is kind of nice, right? You don't have somebody telling you, hey, you know what? We got to get more of this certain type of build. You're like, you know what? No, I want to do this. That's got to be the passionate part too, right? What you're into. This magazine is reflective of the stuff that, you know, you're into, and obviously other people are into too, because it's.
Most of the stuff I'm into is like classic hot rods, custom lowered, that kind of stuff. But I'm also into like mini trucks and custom trucks and stuff like that. So I did a whole issue on the Aftermath Car Club. I call it the Aftermath Takeover here in Alberta. And we featured a whole bunch of their rides. And like, doesn't look like all the other magazines because it's all like newer stuff, but it was a really cool issue too. And a lot of people had a really good response to that one as well.
You gotta get Wayne in your magazine. Rampy.
Yeah.
Hey?
Yes, and I did talk. I talked to him back. I was just telling you about this the other day. I talked to him back in like April.
Yeah,
I think it was April. I reached out to him and I was like, "Hey, I'm hoping to come down to Lethbridge at some point this summer. Can I come and shoot Rampy for the magazine and for the YouTube channel?" And he's like, "Yeah, of course. The guy seems awesome."
He's
stuff
the
like
best
that. And then
guy.
I realized the other day, it's like, "Dang it! I never made it to Lethbridge this year."
Yes,
I feel
well,
bad. We will. I will.
How
get
far is
touch with him again, and we will get it shot. But
you know what would be cool? Shoot it in the snow. Shoot it in the snow.
Oh, that'd be be cool.
Hey. That would be pretty cool.
Rampy looks good anywhere.
I take mine out in the snow sometimes.
He took us for a rip in
What's
Rampy.
What's more Canadian than a hot rod in the snow, right?
Seriously, he took us for a rip in Rampy, and it's fast.
It's a whole nother experience.
We recorded our episode with him in his shop. He's like, "You guys want to go for a drive?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah, okay." And then it's just, it's so you're sitting on top of the wheels, and let him tell you about it. But it's cool.
Yeah.
But this is awesome. I love what you're doing, and I'm excited for things to come. So, do you want to get into that a little bit? So, we were talking. I'm like, "Oh, cool, magazine. Oh, apparel." And we were just talking back and forth. And then you're like, "Hey, wait a second. We could kind of work together and work on some merch stuff for the show."
Yeah. So I behind the scenes, a lot of what I do is graphic design, and obviously with the apparel and all that kind of stuff, I do a lot of that. There's kind of like two sides to my business. Some people follow the apparel side, and that's when they started following me and, you know, were involved with me. And then there's this whole magazine and YouTube side. And a lot of people don't know, like, they're kind of they're all into the same company. It's the same person doing all this work. The apparel and the graphic design is still a huge part of what I do. And honestly, that's the part that makes the company any money right now. I'm super excited. We're doing a little revamp on the Builder Sessions logo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we're going to put some merch and stuff together so your listeners can come and order some hats and shirts and whatnot.
And we're supporting local, which
Super
is what
excited.
We wanted to do.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's a lot more, but I don't want to give a ton away, but we're really excited and we're going to have really dope merch soon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excited. I'm excited to build this into a long-term relationship here.
Of course. This is so sick.
Yeah, I've listened to almost every episode so far.
Wow.
So
jeez. I haven't even
really
listened to every
podcast so far.
I don't think Hoff listens at all. What we're doing right now.
Remember how you were talking about how you were kind of shy and you don't like listening to yourself or having you on the camera? That's how I am too. You know, we're teachers. We're always in front, and sometimes with this, I'll see myself on camera and I get weirded out, or, you know, having to talk to colleagues at work, adults, I hate it. You get the kids in front, it's fine, but I don't know, something about the video and seeing me and hearing my voice, I'm like, I don't really like this, but I, you got to build it up slowly, right? You got to get comfortable.
Well, everyone who listens to this, get out there and say, Hoff, we love you.
I don't know about that. You sound awesome.
you guys do sound good. The podcast sounds amazing. I love it. And
wow, thank you.
You guys should do video. I know some other people have suggested to you too, but one thing when I started doing my content was I was like, I'm going to hide behind the camera because I'm not the face people want to see when they go on YouTube or whatever. But I just happened to be in some videos talking about stuff, and those videos wound up getting more of a response because I was there, I guess, more relatable to have, you know, a person associated with what was going on. And so I put myself a little bit out there and put myself in front of the camera more. And yeah, it's been going good.
Now, are those builds that you're working on? Are they like garage builds? Are they in a shop?
Change the subject. Yeah. That was it. That was good. Let's get back to the cars.
Let's get back to the cars.
I'm just kidding.
I'm making notes. I'm making notes on what to work on.
Yeah, thanks for the input. Let's go back to the cars. I'm just joking. I'm busting your chops. But yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, garage built. So garage I've got a two-car heated garage out back.
Nice. Yep.
And that's where I rebuilt the engine for my Oldsmobile twice. I rebuilt it twice because the first time I rebuilt it, I didn't polish the crank, and I should have polished the crank. So I spun a bearing.
Why didn't you polish the crank? Were you too cheap, or you just didn't? Or you didn't want to, or forgot to.
Cheap, and I thought it looked good enough. I was like, oh, this crank looks nice. Like,
all the forums said you don't need that. That's just a cash grab.
Yeah, so it cost me all of my filters and another whole week of tearing the motor back out and down all the way, so I could replace the bearings and get the crank polished this time.
I think more people need to hear that.
Yeah, I did all that in my garage and.
Those garage builds, you know, yeah, like, I don't know.
And I mean,
it gets to be so easy to say, I can't do that
sometimes. Cause I've posted some of my failures on YouTube. Like I've dropped the car a couple times. It's fallen off the jack or whatever. Or, you know, I'm practicing welding on the roof of my 55 Buick, and people are like, if you can't afford to take it to a professional, you shouldn't be doing it or whatever. Yeah. Like people comment that kind of stuff. And it's like, no, like this is what I enjoy doing and I want to learn. Like I'm going to learn on my own stuff. I'm going to try it out. Worst case scenario is I have to do it again.
Yeah.
You know,
and you learn, right? You learn from those failings.
That work was, yeah. If you didn't do it twice, did you even do it at all?
There you go. That's a good thing.
That's my motto.
Yeah. You don't do it 10 times. Did you even do it at all?
Yeah. That's my motto.
When I did the air ride on my Oldsmobile, I went through, two or three bags up front because I kept popping them, and just because I didn't quite have the geometry right one time, and I didn't cut the holes big enough another time, and you know the bags would rub or too much pressure and they'd pop, and I learned from it and fixed it, and now I haven't had any problems with it for over a year. It's been great, fantastic. Same with the motor. Like when I rebuilt it the second time, made sure I did it the way I should have done it the first time, and it's been like my most reliable vehicle.
Wow. I think there's something to be said too about showing that you don't need a state-of-the-art shop to do some cool stuff. Like I've always...
Exactly. Anyone who watches my YouTube channel knows that I have almost no tools.
Like I've always been... I'm such a...
Figuring out how I'm going to do it.
I'm such a... Like... I have a buddy who's got a three-car garage, and it's incredible. And I'm like, well, I need to move so that I can get a bigger yard so that we can build this three-car because he can help me do it. He's also a carpenter, and then three-car garage, and then I have all his plans. And the grass is always greener, and I can do some stuff out of my little single car, and that's okay. Live within your means, right? Don't finance yourself into submission. Like
live in your means, exactly. And then you can get more projects to work on, right? Then you got some more disposable income. You know, maybe don't buy all the tools, and you can buy another project vehicle.
Exactly. Yeah. I buy the tools as I need them. I don't need to have a lift. I don't have a big fancy welder. Jack stands on a floor jack, and
there you go.
My 1955 Buick is going to be on air lane frame, with an LS motor and a 4L65E and four link suspension in the back. I'm going to do all of it in my garage.
That's cool.
Learn as I go.
So as we kind of wrap up here, we'll hit you with the final three. First one being, for anyone who wants to enter into, let's say your industry, or even just like building hot rods, whatever, what's some advice you'd like to give someone who's considering that?
For anyone who wants to get into architectural technologies or editing their own magazine.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
Let's go architectural technologies and just industry building, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So kind of like I said at the beginning, when you're thinking about doing, I think any type of career, really, talking to somebody else who's already been in the industry or working in the industry, let them tell you what their experience is like, let them walk you through what their typical day is, and see if that's what you're envisioning what that industry is like. Mm-hmm. As a young kid thinking about, a mechanic, I'm thinking about somebody who gets to go to work and work on cool hot rods all day and, rev up big engines and that kind of stuff. Right. You're not thinking about the fact, no, you're going to be changing oil and brakes and whatever for 9 hours a day, buying all your own tools, getting home exhausted and not want to work on any of your own stuff. That's, mm-hmm. I went and talked to people and that's what I learned. And that's why I didn't get into it. And then, architectural technologist talked to some people and they're like, yeah, it's fun. You get to design buildings, you're not out in the cold. You're not getting dirty, all that kind of stuff. And then you still got the energy to go home at the end of the day and hang out with your friends or be with your family or work on your hobbies or whatever. So that was more so what I was interested in.
What would be some technical skill sets that would be good to develop getting into this industry?
Yeah, so for an architectural technologist, the ability to picture things in 3D. It's easier now when you're drafting with Revit that you're drawing things in 3D, but I think it's still really important to be able to put things together in your head before you're putting them down on paper. It was something that as a manager and stuff, when I was hiring drafters to work for me, to draw projects and stuff, was something I was always looking for. The people who put together Lego houses and stuff like that as a kid, it gave them that ability to envision things in 3D and put it together before they, to come up with a plan basically before putting it down on paper. And that technical ability. And then obviously it's important to have some computer skills and stuff like that. I'm by no means a computer expert, but I know my way around a computer and can work with a computer. And that's an important part of being a drafter nowadays. Yeah, you're not hand drafting at all anymore.
Yeah, no ruler and pencil. Yeah. And, I remember doing the old drawings in trade school and isometric and, to scale. And it took, I think we were doing it for about 3 weeks and it just drove me nuts. I still got it to this day. I actually want to frame it up and put it on the wall because it's almost like a piece of art again, right? You put all that time and, that 3D. Exactly. I don't know. It's just, it's interesting when you get older and you look back on different things and, stuff that used to be like, I hate doing this. And now you're kind of, you appreciate it. You appreciate the time that went into this drawing, even though this was a little wooden project. You're doing buildings and these, crazy things. But I don't know. You just get that sense of accomplishment. And I remember I learned a few things on that I still carry with me now that, I can hopefully try and pass on to some kids. And yeah, it's so cool to be able to have that. And like you said, to think in 3D. Easier said than done. Some people, hey, yes. Draw this out in 3D, and this you can just see the what am I supposed to do? And then some people are like, oh, a little sketch, right? So, mm-hmm. And I don't know how you develop that. Obviously, you have to practice, but some people have it, even at a younger age, in the high schools, and some have no idea. It looks like a chicken's trying to draw on a piece of paper. So, it's interesting. Top three starting out tools. I guess this might be a little bit different for the, architectural technologist. What would be three starting out tools that you'd recommend.
Oh, for an architectural technologist. Yeah.
A mouse, a keyboard,
like
a computer, mouse, and a keyboard, yeah.
Software. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, like there's student versions of like AutoCAD. I'm not sure if SketchUp still has a free version. It used to be Google SketchUp. What's it now? Trimble SketchUp. I think they might have a free version that you can get on there and use. And that's just like, it's just fun at that point. Like you're just, you're modeling, you're mass modeling in 3D. So you're drawing shapes and extruding them and that kind of stuff. So it's fun software to play around with, and you can experiment with textures and renders and exporting images and that kind of stuff. So that's a fun tool. There's people who use it just as a hobby. So, I mean, that would be a cool tool to get your hands on off the start.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
What about tinkering in your garage and your hot rod? What are two other tools that you're like, if I didn't have this, I couldn't do anything?
So like obviously you got to have like your basic hand tools, like your sockets and ratchets and that kind of stuff. But one of the things that really got me doing more in the garage on my cars was just buying a simple, cheap, like grinder with a 4-inch cutting disc and a grinding disc. And that's what really got me more into doing some of this build stuff. I could buy a small sheet of metal and cut some pieces out, grind it down. Vice versa, I could cut the rust out of the car and try to shape some panels to fit in there. That's what really got me experimenting more in the garage, was like honestly buying that cheap grinder. I've burnt through it since then and bought a little bit of a better one, but that was probably a big tool that I bought. Not the biggest tool that I bought, but that was one that really changed, you know, what I was doing in the garage and what I was working with and stuff. And a good torque wrench too, like that when I was building my engine for the Oldsmobile. That was my first engine build I tackled solo, and having a good torque wrench gave me that confidence that was like, I could look up these specs and I can put it back together and torque it back to spec like I'm supposed to. And all I need is this tool, this torque wrench that, you know, makes that satisfying click noise when you reach the number you're aiming for.
And there's those times when it takes longer than you think it would, and you're like, am I going over? Oh my gosh, it should have clicked by now. It should have clicked by now. It should have clicked. And then it's like click, click, and you're like, ah.
So wait, we don't just hand tight when we're building an engine?
Well,
because I know my hand tight's way different than yours.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm all for roadkill. Like, just give her. Ooga doogas. Like, let's go.
Don't get it right, just get it running.
Torque to spec. There's a couple things that should be torque to spec.
Enough thread lock and it's probably fine,
it's
right?
It's fine. You don't need bearings. That crank can jump out. Well, Brian, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your candor today and your just ability to open up a little bit, share about your struggles, and hopefully it spoke to someone, helped someone out. Talking about your career and now how things that brought you life is actually, you know, helping you also contribute to your family, but in a fun way, and it brings you life and excitement. And as we kind of wrap up here, can you let everyone know where they can find you and anything else you have on the horizon?
Yeah, for sure. So you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all as Cruise Culture Magazine, even TikTok too. So just search Cruise Culture Magazine. You can find me on any of those. And then my website, cruisecultureapparel.com. That's where you can order the magazine or get a membership or subscription to the magazine, as well as all my apparel and hats and stuff like that. And then, there's lots more content on Project Living Dead Girl, which is the 55 Buick, coming soon to YouTube. We just started tearing down the Denali with the 6-liter LS in there. It's halfway apart in my garage right now, so we're wrapping up filming on that video.
Hey, that's like what I did.
Yeah.
I know that. That's awesome. And so all these links we'll put in, I'll put all the links, everything you mentioned in the show notes of this episode. And and look for our merch collaboration.
Yeah.
Really excited to finally.
We'll try and get that out right away.
Yeah, it'll be awesome. So, Brian, thank you once again for coming on. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was awesome.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Hoff.
Thanks, Rosie.
And we'll catch everyone in the next one.